My name is Joe Phelan, and I am an alcoholic. And I've been given strict orders on the time, so sit back and relax. I want to take just a second to feel this magnificent feeling that is here again tonight. The feeling of sobriety. The feeling of being together. The feeling of the true unity that we continue to move closer to. The feeling that my predecessors and yours called the language of the heart. The AA feeling. And it's sure here tonight. You know, this morning the first thing I did was the same thing that many of you did. You asked a God or a power greater than yourself of your own understanding for help to be sober and to do His will this day. And the Atlanta Roundup was born of a power greater than itself, too. For many, many years, many members in this fellowship had a dream of something like the Atlanta Roundup. And as our fellowship grew, it got fractured a little bit, and there really was a need for unity, not only in Atlanta, but in the state. After all, our slogan says behind me that we're all in this together. And 5 years ago, a group of interested members got together. And they started to put together the first Atlanta Roundup. For purposes only of unity in our fellowship. There was no desire, nor is there any that I know of any now, for personal power or prestige or aggrandizement. It was just something spiritual that came. And hundreds, literally hundreds of our fellow members in the spring of 1975 got together on committees, and the first Atlanta Roundup was born. And somehow it seems over the last few years that God has answered the prayers of those early folks. And our fellowship is united and is together, not only in Atlanta, but in the state. And that's what the first tradition tells us, that we need to be together so that you and I can walk one day at a time and continue to accept this magnificent gift that is sobriety today. I've always been in love with the Atlanta Roundup, for it opened some doors to me personally in my own personal life, in my personal sobriety. And I love everybody who has ever had anything to do with it. And that means all 6,000 registrants for the last 5 years at 1,200 a year. But for a moment or two, I want to tell you a little story of one of our members. We don't involve ourselves in eulogies or setting our people apart from each other. But every once in a while, somebody comes along that somehow God, as I believe Him, has given a special quality. A quality of quiet and firm and steady leadership. The kind of leadership that we hear about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In my opinion, such a person was Neely Daniel. Neely Daniel had a very important part to play in the Atlanta Roundup. Neely got sober in 1945 on July the 4th, 35 years ago this month. Alcoholics Anonymous was but 4 years old in Atlanta and in the state at that time. She was elected and chosen as the first delegate from the state of Georgia and I believe the First Lady to the General Service Conference. She is known by people and loved all over the United States and Canada. But to me, even more so, she was in the forefront in her quiet, magnificent AA way of everything that was good and positive in the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous in our area. When Neely Daniel was 80 years old, at even a stage in life for an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was called on to perform her last great service to this fellowship and to this area. She was needed by the Atlanta Round Cup to be a member of the committee 3 years ago. And she didn't blink. And she came aboard, and she was our leader. You see, Neely Daniel was one of those special people that every area in Alcoholics Anonymous has had over the years. And she served us well and quietly. I don't know about you, but I've always had my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Neely was one of my sponsors. She was not my hero, but Dr. Bob Smith was one of my heroes and is. Because somehow he seemed to have the quality of humility and understanding and love and service that I continue to try one day at a time to aspire to. You know, when Dr. Bob's life was over, in the hospital, and he, a doctor, knowing that the end was at hand, the writer that wrote about this called on, Bob called on his nurses and said, "Get the family, the end is here." And the writer who wrote about it described it this way. He said, "Bob placed his gifts upon the altar, his gifts of his life and his love and his contribution as a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he went away." Neely Daniel, last December, knowing her end was near, went quietly away to South Georgia to go to the big meeting, and she too placed her gifts to you and to me and to the Atlanta Roundup, and she went away. My beloved fellow registrants of this Roundup, I ask you now to be with me for a moment of silent meditation for Neely Daniel. And I thank you very much. I want to turn this meeting over to Bob S., the chairman, for tonight's meeting.
You're very beautiful people. I thought I'd take just a minute and be very quiet and scare that Al-Anon of mine a little bit. Make her think that I'd lost my voice, which I almost have. My name is Bob Smith, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. If you would, please, let's start this meeting with another moment of silent meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer. serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, this roundup is truly a part of my life also. It was just a few 24 hours ago that I walked through these doors here, the first Atlanta Roundup. And there's no way in the world that I can tell you, and if you're a newcomer here, please hear this. There's no way in the world that I could tell you that I might possibly one day have the honor to be standing up here to chair a meeting. Just a drunk trying to stay sober, and yet they've asked me to chair this meeting. It's beautiful, and I appreciate it, and I thank the committee so very much, all of you. From the fifth chapter of the big book, may you hear it in the words of Bill W., and only use my voice, but hear his words and what it truly means, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. They are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balk. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We ask his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he was sought. The young lady that I'm going to introduce, the short time that I have been able to talk to her, has thoroughly convinced me that you don't have to be 57 years old to make it in this program. To talk to her is just as fulfilling as to see her beauty. And I'm telling you, to see these young folks come in and to be able to practice this program on a daily basis is a beautiful and wonderful thing. I was going to tell her age and something about a length of sobriety, but I think I'm going to let June do that. So if you would please help me welcome June G. from Los Angeles.
My name is June and I'm an alcoholic. I just can't believe I'm here. I can't believe all of you are here either. thank you. I really, really want to thank the committee and everybody that allowed me. Okay? I want to thank the committee and all of you that have allowed me to be here. I've had a wonderful time. I felt very emotional, you know, particularly today. And the reason why is that, you know, I've hardly been to any meetings outside of California where I'm from. And this whole weekend, you know, hearing all of you and hearing your speakers and you know, and meeting some of you, it's like we all talk exactly the same. I mean, well, you guys talk funny, but we say the same things, you know, with different accents. And I just think it is so incredible. You know, I've had, in California, we have had a lot of times where speakers come from different areas, and I've heard them, but to see you and to be in the minority this time and to see Alcoholics Anonymous working, you know, someplace else and to be a part of it is really fantastic. I don't want to try and change things here, but there's something that we do in a lot of our groups at home that always makes me feel a little bit more comfortable. If you wouldn't mind, would people in their first year of sobriety raise their hands so that we could welcome you? I'm really glad you're here, and I know all of the other people are too. I love Alcoholics Anonymous very, very much. And the longer I stay sober, the more amazed I am with what I have become. I truly believe that absolutely everything in my life, on the inside and on the outside, is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous, conventions like this, and people like you. And so if you don't like me, it's your own fault. When I talk about what it used to be like for me, I very often mention the fact that I took pills. The reason for that is because I took them. It's not to impress you with what a tough dope fiend I was. It's certainly not to separate myself from Alcoholics Anonymous. The reason is, as I said, that I took them and that I was told to share my experience, strength, and hope just exactly like it was. And so I will, I'm sure, mention them tonight. And You know, there were a lot of times when I would finish talking and people would come up to me and get very angry with me for mentioning pills because, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous was for pure alcoholics. And I learned something, though. I found that most of the people who ever said anything about my talking about pills were the ones who were still taking them. And I'm one of those people that, I mean, your speakers this weekend have just been, they've just been fantastic. And every one of them has said something that that has just triggered different feelings and different things with me. I happen to be a person who believes that, excuse me, who believes that I was born an alcoholic. And I don't want to argue about it with anybody. And there's nothing, you know, but just a personal belief for me. And the reason for that was that there was something wrong with me long before I ever started to use any kind of chemicals or before I drank. And I don't know why that was. I just know that it was. And the way that it manifested itself was from the age of 5 years old, I started trying to kill myself. And at that age, I started cutting my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades on a very regular basis. I started, if I was left alone in a car, I would burn all of my fingers with the lighter. I used to beat my face with a hammer. Give a message. Sure.
I've got an emergency. Just seen that book.
Oh. There's an emergency for Justine Westbrook.
Take care, Justine.
Anyway, I believe that there was something wrong because of these things. The way that I've been able to explain it, in many meetings I've heard people talk about when they were drinking and possibly using other things, that they lost their self-worth and they lost their self-respect. And for me, in my particular case, that never happened to me. I don't believe that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous I even knew what those words meant. The only feeling I ever remember having for myself was an awful lot of self-hatred. And that continued to get worse the longer I was out there and the longer I drank and did the things that we do when we're drinking. But that was something that I had long before I ever picked up anything to drink. And like I said, I don't know why it was. But I never liked the way I looked. I never liked the family that I was in. I never liked, most of all, the way that I felt. And I don't know why it was, but I was always more sensitive than other people. It seemed like somebody could call me a name and I could just feel it rip right through me. And I knew that there was no way that I could go out there in that world with that kind of personality. Being that sensitive, there was just no way you could make it. And I hated myself for that. I thought that was weak, and I didn't like it. And I looked around at that time, and I noticed that there were men and there were women. And I watched the men, and in my entire life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never seen a man cry. I had never seen a man, in fact, show any emotion outside of anger and rage. And I took that to mean that those were the only emotions that men ever experienced. On the other hand, I saw women, and I saw them cry. I saw them have nervous breakdowns, and I saw an awful lot of pain during different situations that occurred in their lives. And I looked at these two different groups of people, and I immediately decided the one that I wanted to be like. And I spent my entire life trying to be like what I thought men were, trying to not care, trying to not feel, trying to only experience one thing, and that was anger, hostility, rage, whatever you might want to call it. And that's the way that I tried to live my life. And when I was a little kid, they used to ask me, what would you like to be when you grow up? I said, I wanted to be a boy. And they told me I couldn't because it wasn't as easy back then as it is now. But that was what I wanted to be. I grew up in a place called Venice in California, and I grew up on the street. I was raised by an alcoholic mother. I never had a father. I did, but I never had met him. He lived in Canada, and we had come out here to California, or come out there to California, wherever it is from here. But so I was raised by her, and I knew firsthand all about alcoholism. And I hated her. I thought she was very weak. And I hated this disease that I didn't realize was a disease, but I thought it was just something that was weak about her. And there's nothing I've ever hated more in people and that I still struggle with today than the things that I consider weak. And that with her drinking and the way that she behaved was something I considered weak, and I didn't like it. And I never, ever in my life wanted to be anything like that woman. I just thought she was the most disgusting person I had ever seen, and I hoped to God that I would never become like her. And yet when I was 7 years old, I was introduced to drugs. It's not unusual where I come from, and I was almost starting late back then. But I was around a lot of people, excuse me, and that's what they were doing, and that's what I did. But it did something different for me. It made me not feel. And the entire time that I was out there and that I drank and that I took things, that's why I took them. I'm not here to tell you that I was out there trying to party. I wasn't out there trying to have a good time. As a matter of fact, I don't think I ever took anything so I would feel good. I took everything I ever took so that I would not feel anything at all. And that was what enabled me to live and be the person that I was out there with alcohol and chemicals. To not care about anybody, to not let anybody care about me, to take advantage of people and be very proud of it, to steal, to lie, and to use people. And as I said, to be very proud of it. And the people that I tried to emulate, most of them had been in prison. As I said, most of them were men. Most of them sold drugs. A lot of them ran hookers on the street. Most of them carried, you know, some kind of a weapon. And everybody was afraid of them. And that's how I wanted to be. And that's what I tried to be while I was out there. I tried to be a tough broad. And I ran around with a lot of tough broads. And I never convinced the most important person, and that was me. I was always scared, and I always knew I wasn't that tough. But I convinced some other people. I would have gone to any length to have people think I was tough, to think that, and to be afraid of me. And I did. I did some stupid things. I used to walk the beach barefoot and step on lit cigarette butts. And people, you know, that were down there just couldn't believe that I would do that. And I thought it was wonderful, you know. I wore motorcycle chains around my arm. I have always been, I lately especially, you know, I've got nothing against tattoos, but I am so glad they weren't in when I was out there drinking. Because there is no doubt in my mind that I'd be standing up here with a battleship on my chest, you know. Or in my case, maybe a canoe. But I mean, and you know, it's not that funny. And probably a shark someplace else, you know. And those are the kind of things, that, like I said, that I liked and that I admired and that I tried to do. I hurt a lot of people. And, you know, it's funny because the longer I stayed sober, it took a long time before I realized I had hurt anybody. I really thought when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, just like it says in the 12 and 12, that we were a victim of the world and its circumstances. And that's how I felt. I'd had such a rough life. I'd been raised by this alcoholic mother. And I'd had all these horrible experiences in my life, you know, and there'd been a lot of violence. And I'd had a lot of terrible things happen. And I just thought that my life and the way that it was, you know, because I was this victim. And the longer I had been sober, the more aware I have been of the people that I trampled on, of the people that I took advantage of and that I mistreated and misused. And it's not that I walk around feeling very guilty about this now. It's something that, you know, that I had to deal with, though, to realize that it wasn't all their fault, you know. And I while I was out there drinking, I always said, you know, I'm not hurting anybody but myself. And it wasn't until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized I was always hurting a lot of people. I was hurting myself most of all, but that there were a lot of people that I took along with me. And that's why all of the programs that we have, the Al-Anon and the Alkene and AA, are so important, because it really is a family disease, you know. And there's no one that has this disease that doesn't affect the people that love them and care them, that are around. I did not drink or use for a tremendously long time in comparison probably to most of the people in this room. And yet, by the time I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely nothing. I didn't start out with much, but I didn't. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother made me come. she was sober at the time, she made me come to the meeting, not because she thought I had a problem, not because she wanted me to get sober, certainly not because I wanted to come, but because she was afraid that if I was left alone, I would throw another party and get her evicted from her apartment. She thought, she didn't understand why we kept getting evicted, because I told her that I was having an Alateen meeting. And see, when you have an Alateen meeting, your parents can't be there. And so I would tell her, Mom, you have to leave the house. I'm having an Alateen meeting. And then we'd just all get drunk and loaded and get evicted. Anyway, so she made me go to the meeting that night. There was someone there that I used to drink and use drugs with. And he was sober. And I spent a little time talking to him after the meeting. And you know what? I didn't look either when I got up here. Anyway, I spent a lot of time talking to him after the meeting. And then I went out the next night and I got drunk. Now, I did not think I had a problem. I did not certainly want what you people had. And as I told you already, I had sworn I would never admit to being a disgusting person like I saw my mother. And so I didn't really want to come back to AA, but I wanted to see this guy. And I spent some time talking to him. And in a two-week period of time, I spent a lot of time trying to convince him that I was too young and that I didn't have a problem. And I later found out that non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time convincing people that they don't have a problem. And he finally looked at me and he said, "You know, June, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they tell us that we can't diagnose anybody's disease but our own. So, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception." "I happen to believe you're an alcoholic. And I also happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take everything that this program and these people have to offer you, within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass." I'm sorry if that was profanity, but that was a quote. I would never. And I looked at him, you know, and I knew he certainly wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't talking about the dangers of alcoholism. He was just telling me right from where it was at. And I knew because I'd been on the streets with him, and I knew he had done all of those things. And I had done many of them already myself. And in the fact that pills and the alcohol that I always took in a combined form were not working anymore. I mean, they were working. I was still laying on the floor and throwing up in that sense. But they didn't take away the feelings anymore. And that's just got to be the worst thing in the world. And I had never tried heroin, and that was the last step that I had left. And I knew that that was where I had to go, you know. And so I started to raise my hand in the meeting. And at that time, there were some people who asked me to leave because they said that I was too young and that I didn't belong and that they didn't want me in their meeting. And what that means is just that there's a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous who still don't know very much about the tradition. Now, somebody in my particular case, because of those things happening to me, the traditions are very much more important to me. And, you know, I was looking in I borrowed this 12 and 12 from the literature committee, and there's this thing I want to read, and that it's about the third tradition, which is for me the only reason I think I'm here. And what that tradition says is that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And, you know, they didn't always have that tradition. I mean, before there were traditions, there were a lot of requirements. And as a matter of fact, this is what this book says. We were resolved to admit nobody to AA, but that hypothetical class of people we termed pure alcoholics. Except for their guzzling and the unfortunate results thereof, there could be no other complications. So beggars, tramps, asylum inmates, prisoners, queers, plain crackpots, and fallen women were definitely out. Yes, sir, we'd cater only to pure and respectable alcoholics. Any others would surely destroy us. Besides, if we took in those odd ones, what would decent people say about us? Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think there'd be anybody in any of the meetings I go to back home if they'd have kept that one in there. And so I'm very grateful that they put that in. And so if you're new tonight, I want you to know that if you're here and if you have the desire to stop drinking, there isn't anybody anywhere who can ever throw you out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You have the right to be here just because you say so. And it doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't matter what religion you are. It doesn't matter what your political beliefs are. It just matters that you stay. And if you have that desire, you belong here, and we're real glad you're here, you know. Anyway, these people told me this, and I had been thrown out of every place I'd ever been in my life, and I thought Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. And so what I did is I decided to kill myself, which was, as I've already told you, a very regular occurrence in my life. And I went over to a friend of my mother's house. I went into the medicine cabinet there, and which is the first place I went at anybody's house. And I found the kind of pills that I knew would work, and I took 15 of them. And I overdosed, purposely. And then I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is where the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous started for me. It was on that particular day, really, because I went in and laid in the meeting. And now, I don't know about up here in Atlanta, but at home, we very rarely ask anybody to participate if they're laying in the meeting. And they asked me to talk. I have absolutely no idea what I said, but I know that in a matter of minutes or whenever it was, the next time I woke up, I was in a hospital. I was being given medication to make me throw up these pills that I had taken. And what the pills were, the doctor explained to me, were pills that were to slow down my heart. And that they had been working. And that had I been there maybe 5 or 10 minutes later, I probably would have been in a coma that they could not have brought me out of. And I don't know why that overdose was any different than any of the others that I inflicted upon myself throughout my life. But it was. Because since that time, I haven't taken anything. And my sobriety date is July 13th, 1972. I thought about it a lot afterwards, though, and I think I know what I was trying to say in that meeting that day, no matter what came out. And I usually try and share it whenever I'm asked to share in the meeting. And what that was is, you know what, I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone just a little bit farther than some of you. But I don't think that's very important. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. I don't know if I want what you people have. I don't even know what you have. I just know I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me that if I go back out there on those streets, I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Not one bit. It never has. Dying's what I've been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live for another 20, 30 years the way some of you people have. And that's what I can't stand, is living out there that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And I've had to do the things, whatever they might be for me, to stay, you know. And that didn't mean that people didn't still think I was too young. You know, there were still people who'd come up and say, "Kid, I spilt more booze on my tie than you ever drank." And I just looked at them and I said, "If you hadn't spilt so much, maybe you would have gotten here sooner." Now, I think that one of the important things that I want to share with you is that when I already mentioned how much I hated myself when I was 5, and that got worse while I was out there drinking and using. But by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were not words, and there are none yet, to explain to you the way that I felt about myself. I hadn't looked in a mirror in a long time, and I didn't want to. I hadn't taken a bath or a shower in a long time, and I didn't want to. I hadn't changed clothes or done any of those things because I didn't want to touch myself. Because I thought I was so disgusting that I would throw up if I had to touch myself or look in a mirror and see myself. I just didn't want to be me once again, and now I was without those chemicals, and I didn't want to feel like me, and I didn't want to be where I was. And because of the way I felt about myself, I did not let anybody touch me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lot of hugging and stuff like that out where I live too, and I didn't want anybody to touch me. And I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I lit every one of them myself. I didn't want anybody to light my cigarette. I opened my own doors because I didn't want you people to think that I needed you. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had only one form of communication. And what that was to put people down. The closest thing to a compliment I ever gave in my life before I came here was, "That was a good fight." And that's about the only nice thing I ever said, you know. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 87 pounds. My mother had asked me to leave the house because I was physically violent and had attacked her on numerous occasions. My family had not spoken to me in 3 years. I'd been asked to leave every foster home I'd ever been in, and I'd been in quite a few because of my drinking and my suicide attempts. I had tried to get into various drug rehabilitation centers and alcohol rehab centers, and none of them would take me. Some because of my age, some of them just because of my attitude. And then I thought, you know, right before I came here, I thought, well, you know what? At least I still have my friends. And then one day I was walking down an alley and all 5 of them beat me up. And so when I came to the Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 87 pounds, I had a swollen eye, and I had a black eye and a swollen lip. And they'd sit in meetings and talk about what you're going to do with your old friends, and I never had that problem. Anyway, I came here and I had practiced all my life being sarcastic, being able to insult people, being caustic, and I was good at it. I'm not as good as maybe many of the people in this room, but I was good at it. And I didn't want the people in Alcoholics Anonymous coming near me. I wore clothes that that said things on them that would keep people away. I went to meetings where they didn't like to hear profanity and used a lot of it. And I got to tell you, it kept a lot of people away. However, I met a sponsor, and he was as hostile as I was, and when I'd get out of hand, he'd put his hands around my neck and threatened to kill me if I didn't knock it off. Now, some people need, you know, love and kindness, but that's what worked for me. I understood that, you know. I would have done anything to keep you people away. I smoked cigars. I had a leather jacket, and after I'd been sober a little while, I embroidered on the back, do unto others, then slip. I refused to take my motorcycle chain off, and I didn't wear any shoes. And I didn't have any shoes, but I wouldn't have worn them anyway. I remember, you know, and stuff, I don't even remember how bad it really was. I ran into a guy maybe 6 months, a year ago at a meeting, and we were talking, and I said, Jim, you know, we haven't talked in so long, because I knew we'd gotten sober together. And he said, don't you remember why? And I said, no, I really don't. And he said, well, we were both pretty new, and we were all in a car full of people, and we were going to a meeting. And we went to the coffee after the meeting, and I said something you didn't like, and you put your cigarette out in my shirt. And then when we were driving home and we got there, you slammed the car door on my head. I can't believe I'm alive, let alone I did that sort of thing. But that's just kind of the way I was, you know. I didn't know that you could just go to any meetings, you know, you wanted. And I remember going up to people I'd hear were secretaries and asking if I could go to their group, you know. Can I come to your meeting on Monday? And they were pretty, you know, nice about it. And I went to a lot of meetings. I went to, 20 or over 20 meetings a week, good part of my first year. And I got to most of those meetings early, set them up, and I left most of them late because I tore them down. And then I went to coffee, and I stayed in the coffee shop till the last person left. And then I'd go home and make up a problem and call my sponsor. I don't know how long I've been going to meetings, but secretary would get up every night and they'd say, it's very important if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous that you get the big book. And if you don't, we sell it at our cost. We're not trying to make any kind of profit. We just sell it straight across the board. And if you don't have that kind of money right now, we'll make credit arrangements. And if you're too afraid to talk to us, then steal it. And I had been stealing since I was 5 years old. It was a God-given talent. And I saw no reason to change here. However, I knew that if I stole the big book from an AA meeting, it would jinx my sobriety. And so I went down to the library, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I picked up a copy of the 12 and 12. No sense making two trips. And I didn't feel guilty at all about that, because the library was, I felt about the library the way I felt about most of the places I'd ever stole from. The library had lots of books. Anyway, when I'd been sober a few years, I went in my closet, and I couldn't even get in my closet because there were so many books there from the library, 50 at least. And they were great classics like Misty the Seahorse, things I'd been stealing since I was 5 and 6 years old. And I realized that I had to make an amends. And I loaded all these books, and I took them down to the librarian. And I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that it was necessary for my sobriety to return these books. And that I'd like to make payments, because they want 3 to 5 cents a day, and I've had some of the books for 11 years. And she said that would be fine. And she said something else, though, that I thought was taught me a lesson. She said, you know, it's really funny what you just said. So I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach, and this man came in. He'd had this book for 30 years, and he said the same thing you just said. He says, you guys must do this all the time. And what I learned from that is that most of the things that I have done, somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous has done too. Most of the things I've thought, most of you have thought, whether you admit it or not. Anyway, I got very active. I got active in a home group that I'm still active in. I'm the secretary at that now, the Monday Night Venice meeting in California. And at that time, I became the literature chairperson. And I'd go every week and set things up. And it made me feel like I kind of belonged. And I was told to never say no to an AA request. And that's something that I have always tried to carry through in my sobriety. And I still try to do today. And eventually I got active in general service, and I became a GSR, or a general service representative, and for a group, and I stayed in the service, and I'm still active in it today, and I'm the area treasurer in Southern California, and I love it. I love being active, and the reason that I'm active is not for virtue so much. It's because the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have what I want are the people who have been active. And that's what they did, and so I figure maybe if I keep doing it, then I'm going to get closer to where they are. And that seems to have been happening, you know. I dropped out of school in the seventh grade, and when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I swore I'd never go back to school. So after I'd been sober for a while, I got a job in an answering service, and I can't believe I kept this job, because if they weren't nice to me, I'd just hang up on the people. And yet they never fired me, you know. And I kept the job for quite a few years. And I realized while I was working there that wasn't what I wanted to do for the rest of my life, even if it was one day at a time. And I found out that I got an opportunity at that time to go to a business college and learn how to be a secretary. Now, in my life, that was not even on my list. And had it been, it would have been at the very bottom. And yet I just didn't want to be doing what I was doing, and I thought I'd try it. And so I went to this school to learn how to be a secretary. And I took all their little classes for, you know, secretary, and I did pretty good at most of them, but I had a little trouble with math and typing, both. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. I typed at that school one day at a time for 14 months. And I left there typing 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And I didn't get they didn't give me the secretary diploma. They suggested when I left there that I take a test, which they consider an equivalent to a high school diploma if you pass it, and it's called the GED. So I went over there to take this test, and it was on 5 different areas. I did okay on the first 4, and the 5th one was math. I thought they'd start out with addition and subtraction and work their way up, and they started out with algebra. And then they started doing things I can't even pronounce, let alone do. I couldn't do them tonight. I certainly couldn't do them then. They had something like a rectangle, and then there was a triangle inside, and they wanted to know how many feet were in there. And I started drawing little pictures of feet. I still don't know exactly what they meant. And all the answers on the test were either A, B, C, or D. So I started to pray, and I said, look, God, I'm at the bargain stage of my sobriety. I said, look, God, I'll tell you what I'm going to do here. I'm going to go through this test, and I'm going to pick lots of A's, you know, for AA. And I hope you know your math. And I'm here to let all of you in Atlanta know tonight that God's as bad at math as he is at typing. But we kind of managed to squeeze by and finish that. And then I went out to get a job. I mean, you know, I had to get a job. And I had to get a job in a citizen-y type job. And I had to wear citizen-y type clothes. And work Monday through Friday like everybody else. And I had the foggiest idea. First of all, I would embarrass the sailor the way I talked. And you don't walk in and ask for a job that way. I had no idea how to dress. I didn't know how to wear makeup. I didn't know any of that stuff. Nobody had ever told me. We didn't talk much about brushing teeth or hygiene when I was on the street. And I kind of was too afraid to ask anybody in AA, and so I didn't know any of that stuff. And some women picked me out, and they helped me buy some clothes. And to me, it was like Halloween. You know, dressing up like a citizen. And my feelings about myself, though, since I'd walked in, had changed very little. I still thought I was a dirty little Venice fraud. And I certainly did not believe that I had the right to walk into these companies, into respectable businesses, shake hands with these people, and ask them for a job. I did not feel that I had the right to do that. And yet that's what they told me to do. And I was so scared that I'd walk in and I'd step on their carpet and they'd say, get out of here. We don't want people like you here. And I knew they didn't, and I knew they had every right to do that, you know. And everybody in AA was saying, you've got to do the footwork. And so I'd go out there and feeling the way that I did. And I'd just talk to the people, and I would have worked for them if they even didn't pay me, if they just let me stay in one of those buildings. And finally, one day, I got a job in an insurance company. It was so exciting, you know. And I went to work, and I worked real hard, and on the seventh day, they called me in the office, and I thought they were going to give me a raise. And they fired me. And I couldn't believe it. She said, "I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go. You don't have enough experience." And she said, and not only that, she says, "You don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever." And I don't even know what common sense was, but I knew I'd been insulted. I walked across the street, and I called central office. And I said, "There's an insurance company here firing sober members." And what are you going to do about it? And they just laughed like you didn't send somebody over to pick me up. I thought we'd pick it and stuff like that. I couldn't believe they were just going to let it go. I called my sponsor as soon as I got home. And I told him what had happened. And I said, "You know, I never got fired before I came to AA." And he reminded me I'd never had a job. That's the kind of sponsor I have. Anyway, now it was very hard. I had to go back out there and look for another job, and that certainly didn't help the way I felt about myself. And one day, and I swear I don't know how this all came about, I was sitting in a bank filling out an application and trying to keep from giggling as I was filling it out, knowing my background, which they didn't. And I got to the part in the application where it says, "Due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check." And I thought, oh, no. Now I'm going to leave. And, I mean, I just didn't want anybody checking into my background. First of all, they call one library, and I've had it, you know. And I just didn't like that feeling. And I just remembered what they'd said, you know, about leaving the results up to God. And I don't know, maybe that was the first time I tried. At least it's the first time I remember doing that. And I filled out the application. I turned it in. I got called back on a series of interviews, and I got hired to work in a bank. Now, not only did I get hired to work in a bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if the program worked that good, you know. But it did. I worked there for, I don't know how long, about 8 months, I think, and I didn't feel anything while I was there, you know. I got very sick. As a matter of fact, from the time that I got off chemicals, alcohol and drugs, I was very sick. I had just really abused my body. It didn't show when I first walked into meetings, but I was sick and in and out of hospitals for a couple of years after I got sober. And at this particular time, I got laid off from the job on medical leave. And at the same period, it was in August, and for some reason I thought maybe I'd like to go to a city college and take some classes. And I applied for different things, and things all seemed to fall through, and that seemed to be what I was supposed to do. And so that's what I did. I started going to school full time and working. At night or at different times on weekends. And I started working the one day at a time part of this program. But for the first time that I remember in anything outside of staying sober, I just tried to go to class one day at a time and do my homework one day at a time. And at the end of 2 years, I graduated with what they call an AA degree. And I couldn't believe it, you know. And at the ceremony, my sponsors were there, both of them, and some people in my family. Couple sets of my foster parents were there, and some of my friends. And what they announced when we were walking up there was that I was graduating third in my class out of 500 people. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't even read. It wasn't that I'd never learned, it was just that my mind was so blanked out that I could not read anymore. And I could not believe it as I walked up there, you know. And I never even thought, you know, gee, you did that, you're really smart, you know. I thought, only Alcoholics Anonymous could do this, you know. And I decided I wanted to continue and go on, and I applied to some universities. And I applied to, I think, 4. And I figured whichever one accepted me, that would be the one that it was God's will for me to go to, and they all accepted me. So I talked to my sponsor, and I got it narrowed down to 2. Got it narrowed down to USC and UCLA. And I heard about this thing called a God bag. What it is you just take a paper sack, and you take a couple pieces of paper and you write down all the solutions. So I wrote on one piece of paper USC, and I wrote on another piece of paper UCLA. I stuck them in a bag and I shook it up, and then whatever you pull out, that's the answer, see? Well, I've always wanted to go to USC. And so I put these in there and I shook it up and I reached in and I pulled out UCLA. So I decided 2 out of 3, and So much for the God bag idea. Matter of fact, there used to be this story old timers would tell a lot when I came in. There's this guy and he's wandering along a cliff and he falls just, you know, because he wasn't watching his way. And he grabs onto this branch that is so small, you just can't believe it. And he's hanging on and it's creaking and cracking and he knows it's going to break. And it is so far down, he can't believe it. And he yells, God, if there is a God, do something. And he hears this voice from the clouds say, do you really believe in God? And he says, yes, hurry, do something. He says, do you really believe in God? And the guy says, yeah, hurry up and do something. He said, the voice says, if you really believe in God, you'll let go of the branch. And the guy's holding on to this branch. He looks up at that voice, and he looks down, he looks back up at the voice, and he says, is there anybody else up there? A lot of times in my sobriety, I have tried that one, too. Anyway, I ended up at UCLA, and maybe the God bag works better than I thought. And this, I guess just about a little over a month ago today, I graduated from UCLA. I couldn't believe it, you know. I never expected to do that. I had filled out some applications for other schools, and I don't know, about 2 months ago, I received an announcement from UCLA School of Law, that 8,000 people had applied there and that they were only able to accept 400, but that I was fortunate enough to be one of those. I thought, you know, once again, how could this be possible outside of Alcoholics Anonymous? It's not that sometimes I don't think, you know, I'm awfully smart. I mean, sometimes I think that. I think, my, look at what you've done, you know. Maybe all that drinking was just a phase. You know how teenagers are. I was just sowing my oats, you know. And then I have to just get out the big book and I start reading. And usually I start reading more about alcoholism in chapter 3. And I read where it says that the great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that someday he will control and enjoy his drinking. And I know that there is no way I could do both of those. I could do one or the other, you know. I don't know. There's one other big area in my life. I don't know about any of you here. It probably isn't. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was single, and I've been single most of the time. And most of you have been married most of the time. It's like Noah's Ark. Everybody driving in pairs, and then there's me. And it's been very sad. I thought when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was very envious, and I didn't even speak to married people because I knew that married people never had any problems, that everything was perfect, you know, because they were married. Of course, today I really don't believe that so much. I kind of think you could either get married or live happily ever after. But anyway, if you get sober and you're single, there'll come a time in your life where you're going to have to date, and I think it's a horrible thing. I don't know who invented it, but I think it's horrible. And you'll probably go out on an AA date. And an AA date, I don't know if they have them here, but an AA date is where a guy will come over and he'll pick you up and he'll take you to a meeting. Where else would you go? Then after the meeting, you'll go to Top Coffee and you'll talk about the meeting. And by the time he takes you home, you don't know whether to kiss him goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. I've had more than my share of those. One night I was at the coffee stage of my date, and this guy I was with said, you know, I really like you. And I said, well, thank you. He said, but I like your girlfriend at the next table better. Do you mind if I go sit with her? And I said, why, no, not at all. And he did, and I went home and wrote an inventory. Now, I don't know what gets you to start the steps, but that got me working him. I didn't think that helped. So the next day I went down and I tried to join the United States Air Force. I figured that's it, you know. And the Air Force wouldn't take me, and so I had to call my sponsor. My sponsor told me that sooner or later I was going to meet Prince Charming. And they might even be on the white horse that y'all was hear about. But he said, before you meet Prince Charming, you have to kiss a lot of toes. And so what I've tried to do, you know, through the years is when I just think, well, just another toad on the lily pad alive. And kind of just move along. I don't know. You know, Gracie talked last night about us falling in heat, and I really believe, I like, I don't do that. I fall in love. I really do. You know, I can be standing across the room, and I'll see somebody at the coffee pot, and I'll just fall in love. And then the next night, he'll come to the meeting with another girl, and I think he's being unfaithful. And that hasn't changed that much. I still... Anyway, I took a marriage and family class because I thought that might help at school. I'll have you know I got the highest grade in that class. I was probably the only one who never had a date the whole time. And they told me a lot of things that are very important, you know, about having a marriage that I never knew about. They said, first thing that's very important is that your mom and dad were a good role model for you. And I think, great, mom never got married. There's one down there. The second one is that you can't have had any bad childhood experience. Well, we better not count that one either. But the third one, and this is the one that is the most important of all, is that you have to marry somebody from the same social and economic background as you. I thought, great, now I got to marry a dope fiend from Venice. I mean, why try, you know? I tried so many things. There were so many, you know, there's a lot of women in our area, and they'd always stand up there and they'd say, I really wanted a relationship. And then I gave it to God. And when I didn't want one anymore, I got one. So I'd go home and I'd say, look, God, I don't want a relationship. And that never worked. Then I'd take out the 12 and 12, and you might think that's a very well thing to do. Not the part I read. See, there's this part in here, and it says, people, you know, sometimes we get sober, and we're able to have reconciliations with the spouses that we were with before we got sober. And we see that these relationships are very successful. However, there are those that relationships that can't work out, but these people stay sober and they maybe meet somebody else, and sometimes they meet somebody in AA. And as long as both of these people in AA have a firm spiritual foundation, we've found that these relationships can be very successful. And then it says, however, there are those who are meant to be alone and give their lives to service in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you think, oh, Jesus, you know. Now I have to open a 12-step house. So, but I've decided to accept it, and I'm going to open a 12-step house for men out in California. Anyway, I've got three things I want to share real quick. One of the things that is my family, we're not terribly close. My mother is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today. She has about 2.5, almost 3 years. But we're closer than we've ever been. We haven't attacked each other in a few years, and that's pretty good from where we're coming from. But my family's pretty close now. They're all close, and then I'm not yet. But we're working on it, you know. And it was very hard after I got sober because they didn't like AA. They thought that this was a place for moral lepers. They didn't like me coming here, and I was also raised Irish Catholic, and that's where they felt that I should be, is in the Catholic Church if I did have any kind of a problem. And so they didn't understand, and they certainly weren't accepting of it, and they didn't talk to me until I had almost 5 years of sobriety. So for 8 years, I was excommunicated from my family. And but they did finally talk to me, and we talk now, and the first time I saw him was on a Christmas, and I only made plans to spend 1 or 2 hours with them. And I spent the rest of the time with AA, because AA is my family. And what they said when I was leaving to go back to an AA meeting that night, was they said, you know, I don't know about this AA thing, and I don't know what it is or what it does. But June, we've never seen you so happy. Never, you know. And we want you to know that we're proud of you. And I want all of you to know tonight that before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, nobody was ever proud of me. That not once in my life do I remember somebody saying, we're really proud of you. Because I never did anything to be proud of, you know. And that meant a lot to me. There's a lot of people who are proud of me today. And I'm proud of myself. Most of the time, I don't mind looking in mirrors today. Most of the time, I don't mind taking baths or touching myself. But don't make me feel like growing up anymore, you know. Because I'm not the dirty little Venice broad I was when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't feel that kind of self-hatred that I felt for so long. And I never thought it would go away. I never believed that when I sat in these meetings. And I just thought maybe it would get better. And that's exactly what it has done. Some days it is gone completely, you know, but there's some days where it rushes back. But never so strong as it was before, you know. I went in this convention, you know, oh, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, and I was at the banquet, and we have those out at home, and everybody gets very dressed up. They wear a lot of long dresses and furs, mostly the women, and the guys wear suits. And I remember I was there, and I looked around, and there wasn't one dress I wanted to be wearing except for my own. And I checked again, and I still liked my dress the best, you know. And there wasn't one guy I would rather have been with, and I don't know, I think I was alone, but there was, that was different. But there wasn't anybody, you know, that I wanted to be with, and I didn't even want to be blonde or stacked, and I couldn't believe it, you know. I just kept checking, and everything, I couldn't believe it. I thought, I just want to be me. I just want to look like me, and be wearing the dress I'm wearing, and feel the way I feel, and have the life I have. And I never, ever would have believed when you told me that when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous that there would ever be 1 minute that I would say that. Because that had never been possible. I spent every day before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to die and praying to die. And I don't want to, you know, mislead you. There were a lot of days after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I felt exactly the same way. I just wanted out. I just hated life and I hated living, you know. And it's not like that today. You know, most of the time I love it. I get out there and I look forward to it, you know. I went through, I got engaged to be married this year, and that's something that I had never done, and it was absolutely wonderful. And 5 days later he walked out of my life, and I never saw him again. And I could not believe it, you know. It hurt a lot, and yet I didn't think about drinking. I didn't think about killing myself. It was the first time I thought of homicide. And you may not think that's gross, but I do. I felt pretty good in the ensuing months since that happened this year. And this has really amazed me. And there's a couple of things that have happened, I guess, that have made it, and that's what I wanted to talk about before I sit down. I got involved one other time when I was sober, and I've been sober a long time, maybe, you know, 6 years. I mean, that was a long time compared to everybody else who was married and living happily ever after. And I got involved, and we were together, and it was so neat, you know. And after about 30 days, he went back to his ex-girlfriend. And see, when I got in this relationship, I thought this was the person everybody had told me I needed to wait for. And I thought, oh, God has finally done what they promised me he would do, and this is my person. And when that guy left, I felt again that God had snatched the person that I cared about, just like he always did. He always took anything I ever loved, and he always took anything I ever cared about. And that's the way I felt, still, sober, you know, just that like he was waiting for me, just waiting to see the things that were important to me, and then he wouldn't let me have them, you know. And I stopped praying. I couldn't pray. I was so angry, you know. And I didn't want anybody to touch me again. And I still kept going to meetings, which thank God I have always done. But I sat in the back, which I didn't usually do. And I took my tennis racket in case anybody wanted to touch me, and I didn't want them to. I mean, I was, you know. And I didn't talk to anybody. I didn't talk to my sponsors or anybody because I just felt betrayed, you know. And what happened was I was depressed over that situation for a year. And I'm not depressed. That was the only depression I think I've ever had in my life, you know, except for everything I lived before I got here, but I didn't know what, I thought that was the way life was. But I was, you know, what happened was after a year, I got to the point where I knew that I had to drink. I had never in my sobriety wanted to drink. I had never felt the obsession come back or anything, you know. And yet I was sitting there and I knew that I had to make a choice, a very big choice for me. You know, maybe something that all of you had already made, but obviously I had not. And what that was is I had to decide, you see, whether I was going to live life the way Alcoholics Anonymous suggested it, whether I was going to give up these old ideas. Because, see, when this guy left, I wouldn't let anybody know that it hurt. I wouldn't cry. I didn't say I was in any pain. I just, you know, because you don't do that. You don't let anybody know you care, and you don't let anybody know that they've hurt you. And so I wouldn't. And that's why the pain was so bad. And so I got to this place where I realized I either had to admit to the pain and go ahead and feel it, or I had to drink, just like I always had to drink, to not feel things. And I decided at that time that I wanted to go ahead and feel things. And I don't know how long it was after that, but then, I did get engaged. And when this guy left, I felt it. And everybody knew I missed him. you know, and that I was sorry that it ended. And it just didn't matter. I didn't have to impress people with how tough I was and what a tough broad I was. It's okay for me to be vulnerable today, and it's something I've always hated about myself and felt as a weakness, you know. And I don't think so anymore, because it almost killed me not trying, you know, not allowing myself to be that way. I'm very sensitive, and I am vulnerable, and you people in Alcoholics Anonymous, by your example, and by the times when you share in meetings, have taught me that that is okay, you know. I went to this convention in Tucson this year, and to me that was where I had what I would call my spiritual experience, and it was just this year, you know. And a lot of the people that are here tonight I met there and got to be friends with, you know. I went there in Tucson to the International Young People's Convention. I had only been to one other International Young People's Convention, and that was the year I got sober, my first year, and it was in San Francisco. It was held at the St. Francis Hotel, and I don't know how many of you have ever been there. I never have since. But we got there, and I drove up with a whole bunch of people, and when we pulled into the St. Francis, I had never in my life seen a place like that. Never, you know. And everybody got out of the car but me. And everybody said, "Come on, June, let's go inside." And I said, "I can't walk in there. I can't go in a place like that, not with valets and drapes and, you know, and all those nice things. I just couldn't do it." And I sat in the car and I cried for a long time. And after a few hours, they finally talked me into going inside. And I went inside and I snuck into the room, and I spent most of the convention at the room, in the room. I didn't go to meetings. I don't remember going to them anyway. I don't remember anything about that convention, but hiding in that room, praying that they wouldn't find me and throw me out and embarrass all my friends. Because I knew that a dirty little venom fraud had no right to walk in through a place like that. And that's how I felt the whole time. And this year when I went to Tucson, I had been invited to share there. And the night before I was to share, I was laying in bed and I thought, there's absolutely no way that a person could come from where I came from, feeling the way I did about myself, and be here today. There's no way that I could go from the difference, you know, in 7 years, from that one convention in 73 to this one in 1980, to feeling like a part of, and to feeling like I was okay, you know. Unless there's something up there that I'll call God that loves me very much. I was given a poem, and I always try and share it to close my talk, if I can. Sometimes I can't remember it, but it's the way I feel about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, all of you. In each of you I see a friend, one whose friendship knows no end. And so just for today I will try to be to others what you are to me. You stopped and turned and took me by the hand and steadied me till I could stand. And then until I walked alone, let go my fingers one by one. You did not say to me, "Do this, be thus." You said quite simply, "Walk with us." I tried, and when I lifted up my eyes could see the same vision which had set you free. We walk together now, a pleasant band, which waits for me if I should fill my hand with trembling fingers of one whose spirit must also break her bend and teach him softly what it means to have and be a friend. And so just for today, I will let others see what each of you has done for me. Thank you very much.